History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And we know they really don't have to go untold, as long as we're willing to ask a few questions and take some time to listen. Our aim is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we find ourselves inspired by these stories from our men and women in uniform. Since 2012, March 29th of every year in America has been designated National Vietnam War Veterans Day. And today we get to hear from the recipient of one of more than 350,000 Purple Hearts awarded during the Vietnam War. Who knows how many more could have been issued if everyone who was wounded actually received one. Some are still appealing to the government for theirs. And there are some other numbers that motivate Vietnam veterans, like the more than 58,000 names on the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Wall in Washington, D.C., or the estimate of more than 300,000 Americans and just as many Vietnamese who have died since then because of the effects of Agent Orange. The West Point graduate we get to visit with today in Henderson, Nevada, is 77 years old now, but we like to go back to the beginning. And for Barney Wintermute, that was in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. So tell us what you remember about those early years.
It was great fun. I went to a parochial grade school through sixth grade and then a regular high school. And I didn't come from a service family. And very truthfully, when I was 12 years old, I was at the library and I started reading a couple of books that highlighted the careers of West Point graduates. And I think I went home that day and said to my mom and dad, I said, I want to go to West Point. Didn't get a whole lot of encouragement, but being somewhat vertically challenged, I went out for the wrestling team, and I was a pretty good student, National Honor Society and physical fitness team, and got a congressional nomination, went to Valley Forge for the physical, and I was the first alternate. The first primary candidate failed the physical, so lo and behold, I got the nomination to go to West Point in July of 65.
And you say that, and I'm thinking, have you ever wondered, in the 60 years since then now, what would have happened if that other guy didn't fail the physical?
Well, I think what I was going to do, because I was covering my bases, I had also gotten a ROTC scholarship. And I was going to go a year under the ROTC scholarship and reapply to West Point. But one way or the other, I probably would have ended up in the service.
And when you say reading about West Point graduates and what they did was kind of your inspiration. Do you remember who some of those people were? Are we talking some of those World War II generals and presidents, or maybe even further back?
Civil War, Grant and Sherman and those people, and then definitely up into World War II, General Patton and a few of the other ones. It was just the character that I could see in these people and them wanting to do. I didn't know everything about them, but I knew they were good officers and had the best interests of their country under mine. And there was just something in me said, I want to give that a shot.
Were there ever any days in your first semester there where you questioned whether you made the right decision?
Oh, a couple of times I thought I wanted to be a priest. No, Beast Barracks, things changed over the years, but the Beast Barracks was, in fact, beastly. My first roommate, we went in on the 1st of July. He resigned on the 4th of July, but couldn't get released until they got permission from his parents in those days. Anyway, I think in our first 2 months of Beast Barracks, we lost about 100. My class started with somewhere around in the 12, 13. We graduated exactly 800, so it was a lot of fun. The upperclassmen, some were pretty okay. Other ones major in it, and we used to say, in those days, I guess 4 years of West Point was equivalent to $50,000. And we used to say, yeah, but they pounded up your butt a penny at a time. But I can't truthfully say I ever seriously thought of leaving. In my case, I grew up in an apartment. And first few days of West Point, you're going down the line, drawing your gear. And we went down, got boots and everything. And all of a sudden, the gentleman behind the counter put this big round thing in front of me. And I said, hey, what's that? He said, it's a sleeping bag. I said, what the hell do you do with that? I had never slept out in my life. But I learned how to very quickly after that. But, you know, it's not an experience for everybody. But for me, it fit my character and what I wanted to do. And I guess I was always kind of forward thinking. And I liked the idea that when I graduated in 69, I knew I had a 5-year commitment and a job. And, you know, that was good for me.
And I think, you know, the expectation for anyone going to a service academy is that they'll come in a teenager and they'll come out not only from boy to man, but they'll be an Army officer. The transformation for you, though, I don't think I've heard this story before. You're going to West Point, actually changed your name.
Absolutely. Early on as a plebe in the old mess hall, upperclassmen started looking at me and said, "Do you know you look just like Barney Rubble on the Flintstones?" And I had never thought about it before, but they started calling me Barney, and classmates in my company started doing it. And by the time I graduated in 1969, Sheldon was something that never got said. So I started as Sheldon and ended up as Barney.
Thanks to Hanna-Barbera. I guess I have to ask you, though, too. I mean, if you were Barney, was there a Fred? Was there somebody that you palled around with that kind of resembled the other main character?
No, not that I remember. It was just me on my own.
Mm-hmm. And I guess Bam Bam would be some sounds you would hear a little bit later. I don't want to take it too far here. But, you know, and a lot of people, they probably have an expectation or a view from afar of what West Point is like or what an experience there was like. You were there in the 1960s, a time where America was going through a lot of things. You're there during the Civil Rights Movement. This is the time where West Point had its first African-American football player. It's actually a friend of mine's father. Did that play into how you experienced those 4 years, the bigger picture of what America was dealing with?
I'd like to say there was some impact, but quite frankly, we're fairly isolated. You know, we weren't allowed to have radios in our room. You know, we could have a record player. My father was a editor in newspapers, so I've always loved to read newspapers. But I didn't really have too much. I don't think what was going on outside of West Point had a lot of an effect on me. It had a much more effect on me when I went to Vietnam, came back, and then served in the 82nd and went to Syracuse University in 74. That's when I really started to realize that we had a hard time recruiting for ROTC, because that time, you know, the Army wasn't, wow, something a lot of people wanted to do. So we had a hard time recruiting, but, you know, we did our best. But I think when I was at West Point, I was so personally insular. I was just trying to go to class, you know, get myself through calculus, stay healthy, you know, pass all the PT tests. And I thought, you know, everything will take care of itself when I graduate.
I've just got to ask. I know you're a big sports fan and you tailgated all the UNLV football home games. Did you get to go to all the Army-Navy football games during your time at West Point?
Oh, absolutely. Well, we were there. You still could tie in those days. So we beat Navy twice, lost once, and tied once. My senior year, we were in Philadelphia in the Army-Navy game, and the whole Corps had concocted this thing that during the workout prior to the game, not one cadet said a word or cheered. Everybody was starting to look over, and I know the sportscasters were saying things. We didn't say a word. And then when they went to the locker room, came back out in the field to start the game, we all tore our uniforms off, and we all had white sweatshirts with a 12 on it for 12th man. And then we just started cheering like crazy. So that was a pretty neat experience.
That's probably on YouTube somewhere if someone's dug up those archives. And I don't want to, you know, belabor the point. I'm just curious for you, because very few have that experience, right? It's one of the most difficult places to get into, and there's a reason it's so prestigious. When you look back on those 4 years a long time ago, is there something you see as the best and the worst, or the high and the low of that experience?
Well, probably one of the real highs. We went in on the 1st of July. On the 4th of July, all the new cadets get marched out to the Trophy Point overlooking the Hudson River, and we all raised our hands and took the oath of office. And that was, you know, really, boy, I'm actually here. You know, this is hopefully going to turn out to be a great 4-year experience. You know, I can't really say there were too many low points, just making sure I could get through the obstacle course. I guess some of the more mentally low points, but going through Recondo school and getting wet and crawling through mud, and it makes you think, hey, am I really doing this? But yeah, it was good.
Well, and it wouldn't be long till you're really doing it. And that's one thing I was curious about, as I've seen some of the young men and women at the service academies now, and the world is a pretty tense place, and there's concern that there could be open conflict. When you're at West Point, the Vietnam War is raging. I mean, it kind of heated up right when you got to West Point, but by 1969, when you're graduating, a lot of American lives have been lost. How did you feel about the possibility that, hey, when I get out of here, that's where I'm going?
I know this is going to be hard for some people to understand. When my senior class graduated, exactly 800, you know, you got your branch assignments, and at that time, there were 180 slots where you would go immediately to your basic course, Airborne Ranger, and right to Vietnam. I volunteered for one of those because I was kind of saying, like training to be a fireman and never fighting a fire. I thought, you know what, the government gave me this great opportunity, and I think I should pay them back. So I volunteered for one of those slots. So I was in Vietnam about 9 months after I graduated.
You said some people might not understand. I'm just wondering if your family understood. Did your parents have anything to say about that?
No. They said, good luck, take care of yourself. Well, interestingly, I had gotten engaged to my first wife a couple months prior to me going over. And, we made a conscious decision, not to get married in case the bad thing happened while I was over there. And then I got back from Vietnam. We got married 12 days later and had 38 years of a great marriage.
And I don't want to skip over anything. So you said 9 months from graduation to heading over to Vietnam, but you also mentioned Airborne Ranger School. And from what I hear, that isn't exactly a picnic. Any highlights of that time of preparation and training?
During that, I was still at the time when the draft was going on. And a lot of the soldiers that got drafted go to Vietnam. Being honest, they got drafted, went to 2 months of basic, 2 months of AIT training, maybe a few weeks leave right to Vietnam. In my case, I had 4 years of West Point, and then I had 3 weeks of airborne training, and then 2 months of Ranger training. So, I felt I was pretty prepared physically, probably just as importantly emotionally, to take on the rigors of Vietnam when I got there. I guess the one thing I'd say about Ranger School is we were humping through, or really not after Ranger School, we got to Vietnam. We were humping through the jungle, and it was very damp and moist, and we used to wear what was called a jungle sweater, and we bivouac one night, and all during the night I kept tapping myself all over, and then woke up the next morning, took the jungle shirt off, and it was like a scene from African Queen. I had leeches all over me, my arms and chest and everything, and I thought, well, that's not too much fun. One of the experiences.
Yeah, for a kid who didn't know what a sleeping bag was when you got to West Point, that is quite a departure. What was the unit that you ended up in Vietnam with, and kind of give us a taste of the scope of your responsibilities?
Well, I was a member of the 101st Airborne Division, was in the artillery, but I was a forward observer, so I was attached to an infantry company, that was out in the jungle, and I got into Vietnam, probably flew into Da Nang one day getting your gear. The second day, they pulled out two wisdom teeth. They didn't want them to get impacted while you're out in the jungle. Probably about my fourth day, they put me in a Cobra helicopter and flew me out to the company. And 29 days later, I got my first shower. So we were out there for almost a month, just going through the jungle, trying to find the bad guys.
And, I think people well-versed in the military have an idea of what a forward observer does, but some people might not understand the exact nature of that. You put it in layman's terms for people, what that meant?
Well, it's even harder in my circumstances. A forward observer is a person who works directly with the company commander and fires artillery to support the company maneuvers and maybe fire out ahead of the company to a spot where we're going. And at night we would fire in what were called night defensive fires and fire a few rounds, and those would be recorded back in the artillery battery. And if we should get attacked at night, all I would have to say is fire zone one, and we'd get artillery fire. It was interesting, but what I'll say is really interesting is I was in triple canopy jungle in I Corps, so I never saw any of my rounds. I fired all by sound and azimuth and hoped the rounds landed where I told them to put them. But where I was operating, for the most part, you couldn't see more than 12 or 14 feet in front of you, so it was pretty thick.
Yeah, and I'm glad you noted that, because it's right in the word, forward observer. You're supposed to have a better view of where the enemy is than the guys way back where the artillery pieces are. And you're saying you couldn't see anything. So you must have some pretty good ears.
Not anymore. The company commander would say, hey, we're going to go in this direction and hopefully get to this point in the afternoon. So it would be called recon by fire. So he'd ask me to shoot some artillery. So I knew the grid coordinates on the map and I'd reload those back and, you know, we'd fire the artillery. I remember on one occasion we did that. And by the time we got up to this point where I had fired artillery, we found some evidence that there might have been some bad guys there, and there were some uniform pieces and some ruck pieces around. But no, I also, after I got wounded in Vietnam, I was what's called an air observer for about 3 weeks. You could see the rounds impact from the helicopter, so I got to fire those on several occasions. It was interesting, but I was a forward observer, air observer for about the first 5 months, and then I was what was called a battery executive officer in a 105 battery for my last 6 months, and that's kind of like the second in command of the battery.
It's time for our first break, but Barney mentioned being wounded in Vietnam, and we definitely need to hear more about that, not to mention the rest of his time in combat. You can find a short video with Barney Wintermute on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 2,000 veterans will have visited their memorials for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes. Celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with retired Army Lieutenant Colonel Barney Wintermute of Henderson, Nevada, originally from Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. His 20-year Army career included a deployment to Vietnam with the 101st Infantry Division shortly after he graduated from the United States Military Academy at West Point. When we left off, Barney had mentioned his time with a 105mm artillery battery. You also joked about your hearing not being as good as it used to be. Am I getting the sense that those two things are connected?
Well, it was a little bit of that, but when I was out with the infantry, we got attacked one morning in our defensive position that we had, and probably within 2 or 3 minutes, we had multiple satchel charges and Chinese grenades go off in our right amongst us, and I had a satchel charge go off right in front of me and another grenade go off just to my side, and that probably contributed as much as anything to my tinnitus.
Well, it could have contributed to your demise the way it sounds, but and you said after I got wounded in Vietnam, so we better hear that story. I was going to ask you about what some of the different dangers and hazards you were dealing with were, but maybe you should tell us the story about when you got wounded, how it happened, and where you got hit.
Well, this is when I was out, not with my main company I'd been assigned to, but this other company where the forward observer had been hurt, so I went out to replace him. And I was with the company probably for, I don't know, 3 or 4 days, and we woke up in the morning, and I was making my normal cup of C-ration coffee, and I guess the term is all hell broke loose, and several of them, we don't know how many, had gotten pretty close to our perimeter and threw grenades and satchel charges in our perimeter. So I was hitting the thigh with some grenade fragments and other places. I think this is the thing, you know, people say, well, how do you function? Well, I wasn't thinking necessarily about myself, but what's my job? My job now is to get artillery support. And then we also had some gunships flying over. So I was talking to the pilots of the gunships, trying to direct their fire. So that's pretty much what occupied. But it's kind of interesting. I don't. People say, have you ever experienced an out-of-body experience? Mm-hmm. And I think I can truthfully say for a brief few seconds while that was happening, I could almost see myself next to a tree with a radio in my hand. It was weird. But fortunately, I made it through that.
You know, I have had a few veterans over the years talk about that when they were wounded, that they could see themselves outside their body. It's very interesting to share that. So I'm picturing myself in your shoes. You're hit in the thigh with shrapnel. Obviously, there's blood, there's pain. You said even other places you're hit. But if you don't do your job and get on the radio and call in artillery support and air support, it could cost all you guys your lives. Am I understanding that correctly?
Yeah, because since I had fired in night defensive fires the night before, I'd say probably within 2 minutes or less of the grenades and satchel charges coming, I was firing artillery rounds, and we would start out and then slowly walk them closer to your position, and I was getting to what was called danger close, and I think that probably kept us from losing more people in the unit that day. In fact, we didn't lose anybody. We got several were wounded, but we didn't lose anybody. And those that were wounded, including myself, we got, you know, medevaced out after the engagement was over. But yeah, you just think about doing your job. Seriously. A lot of times it was said that during firefights in Vietnam, upwards of 20 or 30% never returned fire. These are young 18-year-old kids in a very emotional situation. Again, like I said, I had a lot of training, so I knew I needed to do some things to help them out.
And just for instance, if you were so focused on your own injuries that you didn't get on the radio, strong likelihood that a lot of guys would have died, and maybe even you.
That's a possibility, yeah. We don't like to think about that.
Yeah, sorry. Nobody does. But I mean, I'm just, again, imagining you in that situation. You got to feel the pain on some level, but you're able to have all these conversations and guide those waves of artillery rounds in to the point that you guys are defended and could get out of there.
Yeah. When that particular engagement was over and we were being, they're called jungle penetrators. We were, like I said, we were in triple canopy jungle, so the helicopters couldn't land, but they would lower a device where you would sit on it and they'd lift you back up to the helicopter. I remember I said, you know, I should be the last guy out, which I was, the last wounded soldier out. And I was going up on one of these jungle penetrators with another soldier who had been wounded pretty bad in the face. He kept screaming that they're going to drop us, they're going to drop us. And I said, no, they're not. I said, and let's stop swinging this thing. So anyway, we got up to the helicopter. And then here's this little humor thing. We're in a helicopter and we're flying back to get some, you know, medical support. And these helicopter pilots and crew chiefs, they always had this sense of humor. Man, are you guys lucky. You've been picked to fly out to the Navy ship out in the thing. You're going to see some good old American nurses, da-da-da-da, flew to Da Nang.
And how long were you in the hospital or getting medical care before they sent you right back out?
About 3 days. So, they sewed up the thigh. But again, during that time, we're losing a lot of lieutenants in Vietnam, from what I understand. The war was kind of winding down, but I was in the area of what was called the Ashaw Valley. We had some artillery units. We were the only ones who could range into the Ashaw Valley. So they needed people to get back on their jobs. And so I was doing air observation. And then again, artillery lieutenant on Firebase Ripcord was wounded. I flew out on a helicopter at night on Firebase Ripcord, got out there, and 4 days later, we were evacuated right before the North Vietnamese took over the hill. So there was an intense period in my time in Vietnam, about 2 weeks. And then after we evacuated Ripcord, I joined another battery, became the executive officer, pretty much never went out in the jungle again after that, which was okay with me.
After what you just described, I can understand why. And I'm curious, you said, you know, those 2 weeks, pretty intense. And if the thing goes differently here or there, maybe we're not having this conversation. How much did you share with your fiancé back home?
None of the particulars. Just said, you know, hey, I saw some rough times. She never queried. I don't think a lot of people shared that kind of stuff. It wasn't in me. Unfortunately, I had a personality that probably 2 days after returning from Vietnam, unlike some other people, I never had flashbacks or car backfiring and getting all nervous or something. I just went on to the next phase of my life.
And next phases of your life, including teaching ROTC at Syracuse University, my alma mater, as we discussed, and here in Las Vegas at UNLV, some pretty good basketball schools. I mean, Boeheim in Syracuse, Tarkanian in Vegas. And while I mention that, tell everybody what you had your ROTC students do for one of Jerry Tarkanian's home games at the Thomas and Mack.
Well, in those days, Tark would fill the Thomas and Mack, and they had one of those devices that could measure the sound levels, and we'd get that thing up to 100, and it was just a rocking time at Thomas and Mack. And I talked to Coach Tark, and he agreed with me that it might be interesting, so I had a couple of my cadets who were well adept at rappelling. They were up in the rafters of the Thomas and Mack, and just as the game was actually ready to start, they rappelled down to the floor. One of them had the game basketball and gave that to the referee. And I think a lot of the students liked that, even though at that time, I think the country was starting to come back into the mode of, hey, yeah, military guys aren't all that bad. That was one of the interesting things for my ROTC program. We were never really big because, again, you know, they'd say, oh, there's 15,000 people here at UNLV. Well, to be an ROTC, you had to be a full-time student, so that knocked a whole bunch out. You had to be physically fit. Boom, that knocked a whole, you know, you had to want to do it. Boom. So I was probably recruiting for more like a base of 1,000 than 15,000, but we kept enough of it to keep the program alive. But what I did do, or not just me, but my cadre, to keep us somewhat viable in the minds of headquarters, they used to have what was called Ranger Challenge back in those days, and the ROTC units at different colleges would form Ranger teams. I was lucky enough to have a captain and a Special Forces sergeant. We picked a group of guys who wanted to do it, but we formed a pretty good Ranger team, and we would sometimes win regionals, and that kind of kept the program going.
When I'm thinking if any ROTC cadets are listening, they're going to volunteer to reenact that rappelling from the rafters and deliver the game ball. I like it. And, you know, you just referred to the things that you got to go on and do in your Army career, and you spent 20 years in the Army and retired as a lieutenant colonel. But there was a friend of yours, a fellow West Point graduate of yours, who didn't get to do all that. And if I'm understanding correctly, when you were wounded, that may have spared you from being in the same situation that cost him his life. Tell us about him, your friendship, and what happened to him, and what he still means to you now.
He was a member of the class of 68, class 69. And so when I reported in to his company, one of the first questions was, did you go to Ranger school? Yep. So he said, all right, we got two Rangers here, because he was a Ranger. We worked really, really well together. Again, being in Triple Canopy Jungle was kind of hard to figure out where you were. So he had his way, and fortunately I had a map. I could do some back azimuths, and we didn't have any GPS systems in those days. Just a compass and a map, and we'd always be within 50 meters of each other where we thought we were on the ground, but just a great guy. Anyway, I was in his company, another company, and we were on what was called fire-based security, so, you know, we weren't out in the jungle at the time. And FO at another company that was out in the jungle got wounded or hurt some way, and so I had to go out to that company to service that company's FO, because they were actually out in the jungle. While I was with this particular company is the time I got wounded. So I got wounded, went to the hospital. They didn't want to send me out into the jungle again, so they made me an air observer, so I was up flying air observation from Loach helicopters. And at this same time, Firebase Ripcord was one of our last defensive positions in the Yashaw Valley. And Donnie Workman, the company I was normally with or would have been with, was inserted to take some of the relief off of Ripcord. Now, what people should understand is where we were in I Corps, we weren't fighting the Viet Cong. We were fighting the North Vietnamese, and they were pretty good units. So anyway, he got inserted into to relieve pressure off a ripcord, and about the second day he was in there, they ran into a battalion-sized NVA unit. And the bottom line is he got killed, and several other people in the company got killed. So looking back, had this other FO not been wounded, had I not joined another company, had I not been wounded, I could have very well been, you know, with him. The FO was always very close to the company commander. So, you know, when he got killed, who knows, you know, I could have been killed, but it didn't work out.
And how did that impact you at the time when you got that news that this guy, who clearly you respected and appreciated, worked well together, that he wasn't going to go home to his family?
Well, it was hard because he had only a few days left in country, and he had gotten orders to go to Ranger School, which is all he ever wanted, to be an instructor at Ranger School. I didn't learn about his death until about probably 3 or 4 days later, and the manner of his death. I guess people listening to this have heard tough things, but an aircraft was coming in to try and pick him up and get him out of the area, and it was hit by an RPG, crashed, and the rotor blade from that helicopter literally cut Donnie Workman in half. Again, did it, you know, put it out of your mind and get on with the mission and do other things. But you can't, I don't think you can belabor yourself on those items too long, or you lose your efficiency.
Yeah, and you kind of answered what was going to be my next question, because, you know, here you've been wounded. Sounds like you had plenty of other close calls. You've seen what can happen to others. But you were able to really do that, to just kind of put that out of your mind and focus on what's next without thinking, hey, my number is going to come up next week, or I don't know if I'm going to see that fiance again.
Yeah, you couldn't let that fester in your mind, I don't think. And as an officer, your duty is, yeah, get yourself home, but more of your duty is to make sure the soldiers in your unit get home. So that's where most of your thoughts went, as to what do I need to do on a daily basis to make sure as many of these guys get home as should. Frankly, during the time in Vietnam, I didn't think much about it. Truthfully, the most I've thought about it is very recently, having been on an honor flight, I was at the Vietnam Wall, and I saw his name there, and that brought back some emotion.
Definitely want to talk to you more about the honor flight. I'm thinking of some other flights, because you mentioned flying air observation in a Loach helicopter, and some listeners might not know what that looks like. They might picture a big Black Hawk now with all its heavy defenses. I guess the best advantage of a Loach is that it's not a very big target.
Well, it's strictly made for observation. It's not an offensive weapon. It's just a two-seater with a big glass bubble on the front of it. Most of the pilots I flew with were warrant officers. And there's another breed of individual that did some fantastic things in Vietnam, and we owe a lot of gratitude. I mean, a lot of them got shot down. But it was just strictly an observation helicopter. One time I was in one and heard a couple of thuds and looked at the warrant officer. I said, we got hit in a boom. Don't worry about it. So... probably spent a few, probably 30, 40 hours in a Loach, and a lot of hours on a UH-1 doing what were called combat assaults. We'd load up on the helicopters and fly into a LZ, and right before we would be inserted, we'd find out, is it a hot LZ, or are there bad guys there or not? And, you know, if it was a hot LZ, I'd have to get off very quick and get some fires going. But yeah, I have a place in my heart for helicopters.
And without the helicopter that carried this wounded officer out of the jungle 55 years ago, we wouldn't be having this conversation. It's time for our final break, but when we come back, more about his journey to Washington, D.C. with Honor Flight of Southern Nevada. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. When prices start going up, we all look for ways to save. So here's a simple message for you. Look no further than EECU. Did you know you can finance your mortgage through EECU? How about a home equity line of credit? EECU makes HELOC loans easy. And when the car business is all over the map, the auto loan rates are as steady as can be. EECU is a not-for-profit credit union, not a bank. So the members always win. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today, or call 1-800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting with Purple Heart Vietnam veteran Barney Wintermute on a weekend in which America marks National Vietnam War Veterans Day. I'm curious for you, because a lot of the guys that I interview are the rank and file. You know, I've interviewed generals and colonels, but I'm thinking about your position over there, and I've heard you reference a couple times the men under your command, the men that you're responsible for. When you think back now, what do you think we should know about those guys that you were trying to make sure made it home, the guys that served under your command?
Well, again, all of the people, and I wasn't officially their commander, but I was in a unit as an officer. They were all draftees. Some of them, they were called shake and bake. They made sergeant within, 6 months of coming into the Army. But I did not experience any of the things some other units might have, where they didn't perform very well. One case in point, towards the end of my tour, we took the battery up to a fire base that was just a mile from DMZ, and we were up there, and we started taking some incoming fire, and all of them stayed on the guns. They were there, we fired back. And after it was over, some of the people, not in our unit, but in that particular installation, came over and said, "Wow, you guys didn't run into the bunkers." They said the last Vietnamese battery had here, if they took incoming, they'd run in. You guys just stayed out there and kept firing. They were just damn good. I had no qualms about putting my life in their hands, vice versa. They did their job. That's all I can say is they did their job as far as I could see. I think the country owes them all, some gratitude. But, they were only in the Army for a couple of years, did their job, went home, and got jobs and raised families and did a great job over there, though.
Well, I want to ask you about when you came home from Vietnam, but I also, just to make sure, I saw on your wall of medals over there a Bronze Star. Now, sometimes those have specific actions attached to them, and sometimes they don't. Is there a story behind that decoration?
Well, the Bronze Star with the V for Valor was the time I was with this other unit, and I got wounded and continued to call in artillery fire and gunships, and a liaison officer who was kind of my next level boss in the artillery probably heard some of the radio traffic that was going back and forth. So he thought that was deserving of a Bronze Star, so he put me in for that one.
And I know it's never comfortable to talk about yourself, so I'll try my hand. Because you can get a Bronze Star without the V device, but they said you need a V for Valor because what you did went above and beyond the call. That we heard you talking on the radio about the extent of your injuries, yet you're still doing your job and calling in these artillery rounds, so we thought that was a pretty big deal. Is that kind of how it goes?
Exactly. Yep, you got that one.
And how long were you in country?
Exactly a year. Okay. Went there, interesting point, we flew out of New Jersey. A classmate of mine from West Point from my company, he and I were on the same flight. We got to Vietnam, landed. I went with the 101st, he went with the 173rd Brigade. Exactly 365 days later, we met in Da Nang and flew back home.
What are the odds of that?
Yeah.
And I've heard a lot of stories from guys about when they came home and how they were treated, and some even told not to wear their uniforms. What was it like for you coming back?
We landed in Seattle, and then before we got on another flight, there was a few instances where people, were saying some things that, of course, I don't think they understood everything, but they were not too complimentary of us. But that was for a short period of time. And in my case, I got back from Vietnam, took 2 weeks leave. Within 2 weeks of returning, got married, and then had orders right away to go with the 82nd Airborne. So didn't encounter a whole lot of that because I wasn't in the situations where I would have seen a lot of that. And there certainly weren't too many demonstrators on Fort Bragg. So.
Mm-hmm. pretty good security around there. Was there any thought, because, you know, you had mentioned you have a five-year commitment at least after graduating from West Point. Was there any concern once you were sent to the 82nd that you might end up going back to Vietnam at some point?
No, because, let me see, 70, 71, we pulled out in 75. They were pretty much downsizing. I didn't personally, I wasn't contacted. And plus, being in the 82nd, they have a lot of contingency orders to be ready to go anywhere, basically. So now, interestingly, if they said, do you want to go over again? Having been married, I probably would have said not especially. So.
And, I mean, I'm just thinking, too, we've talked all this about Vietnam, and that's really just your first year and a half, 2 years as an Army officer after going through the academy. But you spent 20 years in the Army. Are there some other things that you got to do in your Army career or things you were a part of that weigh significantly in your memory now?
I really enjoyed my time at Syracuse University. At that time, it was a four-year stint. In your first year, you studied full-time and got a graduate degree. And then you stayed on with the ROTC department for 3 years. Got to meet some really fine young students at Syracuse. At this particular stage, being in the ROTC, and there was an Air Force ROTC unit also, they were kind of special to do that because that wasn't the most popular thing to do. But really got to know a lot of these young college students and, you know, really what they were after. So that was pretty rewarding. After that, then I went to Germany for 3 years and was with a artillery unit for 3 years in Germany. So we got to go to Grafenwehr and Hohenfels, shoot a lot of artillery rounds, and pretty much worked up to the battalion executive officer when I finally was ready to leave. Now, from there, I went to the Defense Intelligence Agency in Washington, which was really a whole different. I had always been in, quote, Army-type jobs. This was kind of semi-civilian. I was working on what was called the Soviet Frontal Forces Desk, and we were trying to analyze the frontal forces and put force structure together, what we thought their units looked like. And while I was with them, I was fortunate enough to get to go to two NATO conferences and sit, and at one time I actually got to brief the personnel in this particular meeting in NATO about what we had discovered. But I do remember we had like a level 6 clearance and we'd know some things. I'd come home and I couldn't tell the wife at the time what I was doing. I said, no, that's very secret. Nobody can know about this. And the next morning I wake up and it was in the Washington Post. So so that was kind of interesting. It was a good time. You know, my kids were in middle and elementary school. It was a nice time for the family. And then from there, I got the assignment to come to Las Vegas to run the ROTC program here. And I had 16 years in it at the time, and it was a three-year assignment. So towards the end of my 19th year, I got a hold of, you know, the people, and I said, hey, I'm pretty sure I'm going to retire at 20. Because my family's here, my son's going to be a senior in high school, and I just didn't want the disruption. So I said, you know, why don't you just leave me here for another year, which they did. So it turned out nice. So one day I took off my Army green uniform, and a couple weeks later put on a suit and went to work for Citibank.
And you're still here. Las Vegas has changed a little bit over those 40 years, and then there sure is a lot going on here now. I just have to ask the follow-up question with your time in Washington with the DIA, and there are probably some things that you still can't talk about that you knew, but I'm always fascinated for all the things that we know happened. I wonder what almost happened that could have really changed the world. And when you said you're evaluating Soviet forces and where their forces would be if the Cold War turned hot, do you have an opinion or a view on how close we came to being an open conflict with the USSR, or anything that might have made a difference in preventing that?
I wasn't privy to too much information that would lead me to be able to answer that, but I'm going to go back an assignment. Mm-hmm. And when we were in Germany, we had two corps at that time in Germany, but would have been tremendously undermanned as far as what the Soviets could throw against us. But what I came to realize is because of the way our army is structured, you know, our soldiers down to E5, E6 level are given maps and given the initiative to if, you know, they lose orders or somebody assumes they go on and do something. And what we knew, we pretty much knew, is that wasn't true in the Soviet Army. I mean, they didn't give their lower NCOs maps. And we always thought that, you know, you have all these great plans, but once the first shots were fired, it was going to be unbelievable chaos going on. And we thought in that chaos, we would be much more effective because there'd be a lot of small unit engagements going on that we thought we had a lot of better chance of winning. The one thing I'll say, interestingly, when I was with DIA, and this is back in the mid-80s, at that time, our satellites, and I'm not telling anything out of school, if our satellite was positioned just right and the weather was okay, we could read the name tag on soldiers in the Soviet Union. So I can't imagine what today, how sophisticated our, you know, our things are. It's just got to be unbelievable. Now, you know, I'm an optimist. If it's Christmas and I see a horse walking down the street, I'm getting a pony for Christmas, man. I'm an optimist, so I just thought, you know, with the nuclear deterrence, I thought, I don't think people can be that crazy, because they knew, you know, even if you strike first, there's going to be always a lot left to come back at you. So, I didn't worry about that too much. We may have been very close, but I don't know.
Well, one thing I know, I think you sent chills up a lot of people's spines when you talked about being able to read the name tag on a Russian soldier in the 80s, let alone what technology has given us today. Another thing that's happening today that's making a big difference is the Honor Flight Initiative and the Honor Flight Network. Honor Flight of Southern Nevada has done a phenomenal job here in the Las Vegas area. And more than anything I've seen, it's righting the wrong of how veterans were treated 50, 60 years ago when they came home from Vietnam. And I've seen it time and time again. It was not even the intent of Honor Flight initially. That was geared for the World War II guys. And I really believe it's more important for the Vietnam generation. And you got to share that experience with 35 fellow veterans going to Washington, D.C. It sounds like if you weren't such a football fan, you never would have ended up on the Honor Flight, huh?
No, that's for sure. I had never heard of Honor Flight, quite frankly. I didn't know anything about it. I'm at a tailgate one time. My two sons and I have gone to almost every UNLV home game, and I happen to be wearing my Vietnam veterans hat, and a representative of Southern Nevada Honor Flight came up to me and said, "Hey, what do you know about Honor Flight?" I said, "I don't know anything about Honor Flight." She said, "Well, let me tell you about it," and sent me an application. And before I knew it, I was pretty much engrossed into what Honor Flight was all about. So I was fortunate this last October to go on a flight. And just the send-off at the airport, there was just fantastic. But the 3 days were just jam-packed with visits to the Vietnam Memorial, the Korean Memorial, the World War II Memorial. It was kind of emotional at times. And then no matter where we went, walking around Washington, D.C., everybody would say, "Thank you for your service." And that means a lot, I think, to us that hey, you know, we were doing this and not just for ourselves. So I think anybody that doesn't know about Honor Flight, if you're deserving to go and you're a veteran, seek out the Honor Flight people in your area and say, "Hey, I'd like to go." And I'll tell you, it'll be the most rewarding experience of your life. Absolutely.
And when you got to the wall, and I've talked to so many Vietnam veterans who are apprehensive about going to the wall, because they don't know how they're going to handle it or if they can handle it. When you got up there and there's 58,000 names, including your friend Donnie Workman, what did those moments there feel like? What did they mean to you?
Well, you know, anybody that hasn't been to the wall, there is such power in the simplicity of that monument. You know, it's granite slabs with 58,000 names on it, and, you know, no fantastic obelisk or anything around there. But it's powerful in its simplicity, and it brings back some memories. And in my case, when I went and made a sketch of Donnie Workman's name on the wall, you know, it brought back some thoughts like, "Geez, I wish I was there to help you, but maybe not." Not to be funny. Yeah. It's a powerful experience. And another honor flight recipient who was with me, in fact, he was a 63 graduate of West Point. He got fairly emotional because he had never been there, I don't think. But he looked for the name of one of the ammunition drivers in his, he was in Vietnam, in his 8-inch unit. And I think he only lost one person, but this driver, they mined the road and he didn't know. And the driver ran over mine and blew up. And when he saw that individual's name on the wall, he had to take a few breaths. But it's powerful.
I've got to ask you about when you got back here to what's become a pretty busy airport that's got a lot going on and easy to get lost in. But I'm guessing the airport the day you came back from the honor flight looked a little different than McCarran Airport any other day.
Oh, I've flown in and out of, I guess I should say, Harry Reid.
Yeah, it's Harry Reid Airport. Pardon me. I'm dating myself.
Several times. But when you get off the airplane, and, you know, it's about a 4.5-hour flight, but prior to getting off the airplane, when you're flying back, the honor flight people come around and hand you this big envelope full of letters and notes from, you know, organizations, not only just from Nevada, around the world, and, you know, the Daughters of the American Revolution, just all, and then grade school kids. And I got one where he said, "Oh, Mr. Wintermute, I hope you weren't wounded too bad in World War II." But anyway, you know, boy, that starts to get you in the mood and gets you a little teary-eyed. And then you get off the airplane, and there are just hundreds of people waving the American flag and just cheering and clapping and thanking you. And that went on probably for a quarter of a mile as you're walking through the airport getting to the exit. And pretty powerful moment. And if anybody can go through that and not be somewhat emotional, they're pretty strong.
If there's anything that I haven't asked you about, feel free to share. I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country and for sharing a story with us that nobody else could share with us. As the country pauses March 29th for National Vietnam War Veterans Day, what's that day mean to you? What do you think those of us who weren't there, who didn't serve, should know or understand about all the Americans who did go over to Vietnam?
Well, you know, there were very different people that went to Vietnam. There were the draftees. There were people, officers that graduated from ROTC programs, from the military academy. There were good old hardcore sergeants, E6, E7, Z8s, that, you know, really hold the Army together. You had a wide breadth of people that went to Vietnam, but once they got there, they were all pretty much the same. You know, they all wanted to do their job. They all wanted to get back to the world, as we used to say. But I think for the absolute most part, when they got there, they understood the importance of serving their country. But I'm going to say, and this has become a phrase, and I'm not sure everybody understands it, but I think what it does is bring back the idea of the band of brothers. And I think when all these people will meet in a room at a hotel here on Saturday, and they all have had the shared experience of Vietnam, you know, and we'll all welcome each other back home. I think for some, it's a very healing experience. For others, it's a validation. I think it's important.
One last question that I thought of, and like I said, anything else that you want to add? If there's not something here, don't feel obliged. I'm not trying to put words in your mouth or thoughts in your head. I'm just thinking back to your growing up in parochial school, joking that you might have wanted to be a priest for a while. When you look back over all your time in the Army and all your experiences, especially some of those hairy moments in Vietnam, do you ever assign any divine intervention or control to any of those situations?
I don't know. That's a tough one. What I will say is, if you had asked the question, do you wish you had done something different? I would say no, because obviously in your life, if you change one thing, I wouldn't be sitting here right now in a beautiful home with a beautiful wife talking to you. So it was all good.
I try not to miss an opportunity to ask someone this question too, because I can tell you're still very active and you enjoy life. But if you look back over 77 years, Is there something you'd say that you're most proud of or most thankful for?
Well, probably having the opportunity to go to West Point, have a career in the service, have three great kids that are all still here in Las Vegas. My daughter graduated from UNLV, great grandchildren, and a beautiful and wonderful wife who is sharing the rest of life. And next May, we're going on a safari, so life can't be any better, can it?
I guess not. That is Barney Wintermute. And thanks to Belinda Morse of Honor Flight Southern Nevada for connecting us to Barney, who even got to be honored at Allegiant Stadium during a Las Vegas Raiders game, thanks to his Honor Flight connection. Remember to thank all the veterans in your life this weekend. And in honor of National Vietnam War Veterans Day, say those two words that mean more than you know to just about any Vietnam vet you might encounter. Welcome home. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.